and welcome to the Deep Dive Radio Show. As always, I'm your host, Nick Espinoza, and we're going to be talking about all things cybersecurity, cyber warfare, and technology related, and I think we're one of the only ones out there that's doing that right now. If you'd like to be part of the radio show in any way, shape, or form, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Nick A ESP. Again, that's Nick A ESP. Or you can send us an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. We have an action-packed show as always. There's always a lot to cover, so stick around with us as we deep dive into a topic and we catch up on everything else. So without further ado, let's begin. And we've got a great show for you this week. We're going to be catching up on a whole bunch of different news. Our breaches of the week is literally going to be the longest breaches of the weeks we've ever done. And I know I've said that before, but it's literally the truth here. And also our deep dive this week is going to be, is America under attack? I'm going to lay out all the information from you spanning back from the last couple of years up to literally last week. And you decide, are we under attack? I think the answer that you come up with may actually surprise you. Or maybe not. I'm not sure. But either way, it's going to be a great time. Sit back. Let's enjoy it. And as always, we're going to start with the news. And in travel news, you may actually be ending up in a government-owned facial recognition database, courtesy of the U.S. government and TSA and all of this. And here's what's going on. And so basically, the Trump administration has mandated that essentially by 2020, we are going to have in the major airports in the United States for international terminals of people coming in and going out, a facial recognition system that basically is going to look at every traveler, put them into a facial recognition database. And this obviously is for security and analytics purposes. We don't want a terrorist walking off of a plane. And the goal is to have that facial recognition database automatically scan and alert us that, you know, we have a terrorist entering the country, et cetera, et cetera. Now, here's the thing. Basically, the United States government is scrambling to put this in to the top 40 airports in the United States, which is what the mandate says for right now, because that's where a bulk of people come through. We are looking at over 16,000 flights a week that would be scanned to over 100 million people every year being put into this database, myself included, because I travel internationally for work. So obviously, this is a bit of a concern for me as well. But here's the thing. The way these guidelines have been written is the U.S. government is partnering with the companies that own the terminals, specifically the airline companies. So, for example, let's say I'm flying United or American Airlines and I'm flying into the United terminal internationally. Basically, the impetus is on United to make sure the system is up and running. And the United States government has said, yeah, well, we're going to share the information with you. And here's the kicker. They really have not specified, especially in the original language, what a United Airlines or an American Airlines, or just take your pick, they're all in the same boat, what these airlines can actually do with this. Can they sell this to third-party companies? Can they use this for their own database? You know, maybe they don't like me for whatever reason. I've spoken rather negatively about them, you know, on the air or something. I don't think I have, but if I have, maybe now they've got my face and every time I walk through the terminal, they're just going to block me from getting on a plane, whatever that is. You know, who they sell this to, what third parties then do with it is kind of up in the air. Now, the government has attempted to strengthen the language, of that in the last month or two, but it is still wide open for interpretation. And so I would hate to think that, you know, a United or American or Delta or whoever, you know, could take my image, take my picture and my information, sell it to somebody else for either advertising purposes, or maybe they resell it to somebody else. And the next thing you know, we've got somebody somewhere with my information that's getting a data breach by virtue of this, or doing something malicious with my information, and not just mine, 100 million. And so I think that is a very interesting proposition. But one of the things that we've had serious debates over is doing things like centralized and nationalized IDs. Other than passports, we don't have a national ID system. We really don't. Most of us, when we're verifying our identity, are using things like our state-issued driver's license. And so I'm here in Illinois. I'm going to pull out my Illinois driver's license. If you're in California or Oregon or, you know, Vermont or New York, wherever you are, you're pulling out your state's driver's license to, let's say, do things that require an ID, like purchase alcohol or, you know, whatever that is. And we have not really wanted this centralized system. And now the government seems to be building it, through the airports. and through other ways as well. And I find that to be very interesting, you know, as we continue to talk about ramping up surveillance in the United States. And so take that for what it's worth. But if you are an international traveler and an American citizen, you are soon to be in a facial recognition database by the U.S. government, owned by the U.S. government, and pretty much given to whatever airline you use for them to do essentially what they see fit. So there you go. And that is your airline slash facial recognition slash government database, I guess, news of the week. Bluetooth news, and I found this absolutely interesting. I think you guys will appreciate this as well. A lot of you guys are using things like Apple AirPods or Bose Sound Sport Plus. These are like 100% wireless. So in other words, you have two earbuds you're sticking in your ear. They're not attached to each other or to anything else, and they are wirelessly connecting to each other and then connecting to your phone or your device via Bluetooth to stream audio to you. You might be listening to me here, through a pair of earbuds right now. And so heads up, this bodes for you. So 250 scientists across 40 different countries basically petitioned the World Health Organization and the UN to basically say that they believe that these are actually harmful and carcinogenic, basically raise your risk for increasing cancer, if you're using these. What they're saying is that it's creating an electromagnetic field that is basically going through your brain, to connect one earbud to the other earbud and then out, and that electromagnetic field is harmful. Now, what's interesting about this is that, the World Cancer Society and some others have come out and said, this is what we believe is, the threshold for an increased risk in cancer by electromagnetic fields and wireless fields. And these scientists are contending that we don't have enough research and that the threshold for that is actually less. Now, full disclosure, I actually use wireless earbuds. I'm not an Apple person, but I do use Bose Sound Sport. I think it's like the Sound Sport Plus or whatever it is, and comes with a nice little charger case and everything, and they sound great, and as I'm walking through airports and all of that, I've usually got these things in my ears, whether I'm listening to a podcast or music or whatever it is, and I'd really hate to think I'm cooking my brain, just to have the convenience of something like this out there, but it really makes you stop and think. And the person that's leading this is a Dr. Moskowitz out of UC Berkeley. And he's basically said, he's like, yeah, this can't be good. this isn't like not just like even or neutral. He's like, this is a problem that we need to be addressing here. And so I'm curious to see where this is going to go. I'm curious to see if we're actually going to be doing more tests. And if that is the case, what are the long-term effects? How does it going to take me 20 years to, get a 1% increase in risk of cancer? And let's say genetically, I have no history of cancer, then do I really care? Or maybe I'm very cancer prone, in which case I would stay away from these things like a 10-foot pole, with that 10-foot pole. But we have wireless everywhere. It's all around us. I'm literally sitting in a radio station right now that is broadcasting wireless. I'm sitting next to my, phone, which is maybe 5 feet away from me, that is broadcasting, a cellular signal. I mean, we can't get away from these. And I can understand about, sticking earbuds in your ears and, having them, basically pass through your brain. But we are constantly surrounded by electromagnetic fields. We are constantly surrounded by technological wireless signals. My laptop here in the radio station is connected to the Wi-Fi in the radio station. And I do that because I know it's secure. It's not a public Wi-Fi. So I do practice what I preach. But you understand what I'm saying. And so we're going to see what happens here. And I know I've mentioned before that a lot of towns are having issues deploying 5G for very similar issues, but they didn't have problems with 4G, which actually has a more powerful antenna, but there's less 4G deployment. In other words, in order to get a proper 5G coverage signal, you need to deploy more of these things in more strategic locations. But back to Bluetooth, if you're wearing these things, heads up, this is what 250 scientists from 40 countries thinks, and they are petitioning the UN and the WHO to do something about it. So take that for what it's worth, and there you go. That is your Bluetooth news of the week. If you're one of the million Americans on disability, you're definitely going to want to listen to this. And this is not an advertisement, although it may sound like that. This is actually a news item, and I found this really interesting. The Trump administration is currently looking at a way to basically take everybody that's on disability and then gain access to their social media accounts, basically to look for fraud. And so, in other words, let's say you're on disability from the government and, you're you know, you hurt your back, whatever that is. The government now basically says, okay, well, we want access to your Facebook or Twitter or whatever you're doing so that we can look at your pictures to make sure that you are not faking it. So in other words, if you are, you know, on social media and you've got a bad back and you're getting disability for your bad back, and here you are snowboarding or playing basketball or doing something that is the antithesis of this, they can say, aha, you are defrauding the government, and we are going to revoke your benefits. Now, I can understand the logic of this. I mean, if you're basically, you know, on this program and they are giving you money, and it is a benefit, not a handout. I actually made that mistake when I talked about this in a video, and you know, one of my listeners or viewers rightfully pointed that out. So I'm going to clarify that it is a benefit. You pay into this as you pay into Social Security and everything else. You know, I can see, though, that they don't want people basically defrauding this, getting money for free, especially, you know, if you've got legitimate people that have legitimately hurt themselves and need disability. And so I can understand that. But at the same token, we have this whole privacy thing, and I don't necessarily know if catching fraud in this way is going to be the smartest thing to do. And it's for a couple of different reasons. First off, studies have shown overwhelmingly that people sculpt who they are on social media. Basically, you're not putting out all of your dirt and your disasters and your problems and your issues, you know, in Facebook. I mean, there's sometimes some of that, but usually the pictures that you're posting are those that are of you smiling and happy, whether you're at a party or you're out with your family or, you know, whatever it is. We're usually not putting like, oh, here's me and my unflattering picture of my broken back or, you know, whatever it is. And so I don't necessarily know how effective that would be, you know, for the government to look at, especially when, you know, you've got other things to look at, such as doctor's reports and all that kind of stuff. So I don't necessarily think it's going to be effective, not to mention the fact we have a right to privacy. What we do and do not share, you know, is up to us. And so, you know, take it for what it's worth. I'd be curious to know what you guys think about this, as I did with, you know, my listeners and those people that watch my videos when I was talking about this, you know, a short while ago. But I think it's an interesting thing, but I also think it kind of shows where we are going in terms of ramping up surveillance. And quite frankly, I could probably do a deep dive on this entire subject as well. You know, America turning into a surveillance state. There's a ton of evidence on that. But as of right now, if you're on disability, heads up on that. I think this is coming to fruition, or it seems that they are attempting to see if they can make this work. And quite frankly, I think most of us are not going to be big fans of that. So take that for what it's worth. But that is your U.S. government disability benefits news of the week. You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. And in this news item, I want to tell you about Ernest Quintana. Now, you probably don't know who Ernest is. He's not famous in any way, shape, or form. But what happened was, a couple of weeks ago, he checked himself into a medical facility, a Kaiser Permanente medical facility in California. And he basically got checked in with his family. It was an ER visit. He's an older guy, had an emergency. And the nurse basically said, yeah, well, you know, we're going to check you out, and the doctor's doing the rounds, and the doctor will be in. And so he thought, great. The family thought, great. You know, we're going to see the doctor and everything. And a couple of minutes go by. I'm not sure how long. The articles didn't say. But when the doctor came in, it was actually a robot. Now, what Kaiser Permanente had put in this medical facility was basically a robot on wheels and a video screen of the doctor on it from a remote location. And this doctor then, very, very dispassionately, through this robot, delivered to Ernest and his family that Ernest's lungs were failing and he didn't have long to live. Now, I presume Ernest has passed away since then. It's been a couple of weeks. But I think this is actually rather interesting, because one of the things that we are seeing as we are shifting towards automation, we are shifting towards, you know, more robots taking over tasks and doing functions and giving us remote access for, let's say, better cost savings, is we may be losing the personal touch. We may be, you know, losing that human interaction. And we've seen that go down over the years, thanks to things like social media. Studies have shown that we are getting together with our friends with less frequency as life gets busier. And so we are relying on social media to keep up with what they're doing, looking at their Facebook posts, their check-ins, their tweets, you know, whatever that is. And there is a certain disconnection there that we have with the human experience when we are going this route. And now, when we are talking about something as, well, unfortunate and as intimate and as awful, you know, as learning that you're going to die, and it's from, you know, basically a guy on a screen on a motorized robot, this very much upset his family. And I can completely understand why, But I also know that this is the future. This is where we're going. You know, this is not going to be new. We're going to be seeing more of this. And I'm wondering when that's going to flip. I'm wondering when it's not going to be a news story because it's just what we do and who we are. And you know, we just, I don't want to say didn't heed the warnings, because I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with this beyond that lack of human interaction. But do we really want to go there? Are there some jobs that just robots shouldn't be involved in? And maybe that's delivering deathbed news. You know, so you tell me. I'm curious to know what you think about that. But that is your robotic, dispassionate medical news for, you know, as I'm trying to make up categories here for this. And I wish nothing but peace for Ernest's family. And I'm sorry for your loss. If any one of you guys are listening to this, you know, that's kind of the wrong way to hear this kind of news. And in U.S. Navy news, the U.S. Navy has basically come out and said that they are under cyber siege. Now, they went under, or basically went through an internal audit, and what they found was actually rather astonishing. They have found that Chinese hackers have been in and out of that network. The goal is to steal intellectual property or secrets from the U.S. Navy, basically to strengthen the, you know, Beijing government's military while eroding the U.S. advantage. And so major senior officials from the Navy have come out and basically said, this is like a virus. If we don't do anything, we're eventually going to die here. And it's a very serious problem. Now, I've also talked about this before in the past. The U.S. Navy got hit. Their submarine warfare division got hit, and data was exfiltrated from, you know, basically from their secret databases over to China, which is a very serious undermining of U.S. military capability, especially when it comes to naval power, you know, under the sea. And so this is an ongoing problem, and the Navy is stating that this is increasing. They are seeing a rapid growth, you know, of this. And interesting in this report is while they are primarily pointing the finger at China, they're also saying that they have found both Russian and Iranian attempts to basically penetrate their networks and get in as well. And so I understand, I mean, when we're talking about governments hacking governments, every government's probably hacking every other government and all of this. But when it comes to light, it's usually pretty shocking. And so here we are, the Navy literally saying right now that they are under cyber siege. They are basically in cyber warfare right now, trying to defend what they have. And we know that as we add, you know, the thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of naval personnel into this, you know, all it takes is one person with some strategic access and not enough awareness training to basically open that email or click that link or share that information. And I know in a previous radio show, I mentioned just how easy it was for NATO to basically fish its own troops, spending $60 on Facebook to create fake ads and groups and all of this just to have these you know, soldiers feel camaraderie with the fake ads and basically give up things like troop movements and battalion strengths and orders and have them desert posts in some cases. And so this is an ongoing issue. It's not going to stop anytime soon. And the more we are, you know, in tune with stuff like this, the better it is. But the U.S. Navy right now has some serious, serious issues, you know, with state-sponsored hacking and cyber warfare, and it's only getting worse. And so I think that we need to make sure that we are continuously ramping up our security, not just for the Navy, but for the U.S. government, and as well as ourselves and our companies and our families and all of this. But I think it's, you know, it's rather telling that the Navy themselves are coming out and openly admitting, yeah, we have a serious Chinese hacking problem. We have a Russian hacking problem, and we have an Iranian hacking problem to a lesser extent. So take that for what it's worth. But that is your naval news of the day. And in Mark Zuckerberg news, that is Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, he's basically doing a 180 on what made him a billionaire. Now, he basically came out about 2 weeks ago and said that he wants to change the nature of social media in communication. Basically, instead of focusing on things like public posts, which is essentially what Facebook is all about, he wants to focus on private and encrypted communication. And he went on to say that essentially the way he looks at Facebook is that your Facebook profile, your platform, your wall, your feed, whatever you want to call it, is essentially the town hall. And so you can post information on the, you know, out there, and then everybody in your town can see it and interact with you and all that kind of stuff. Now, what he wants to do is be the, instead of the digital town hall, he wants to be the digital living room. In other words, you invite in those friends that you want, and then you share with them, and then nobody else can see it. Now, I find this actually very interesting because, one, I mean, he is one of the world's richest men, primarily because he made money data mining the ever-living bejesus out of every digital town hall that he did, that he made, and then sold it to advertisers. And so I'm curious to know how he is going to make money, if he is focusing on private and encrypted communication, because by default, that means you shouldn't be data mined. If it's private, it's private to you. And so Facebook or whatever Mark Zuckerberg's next venture is going to be called, and maybe it's just Facebook, he is going to, he's going to focus on this. Now, he is integrating Messenger, I think Instagram and WhatsApp. I think those are the three that he's integrating to create this new platform. But I want to know how it's going to make money. I want to know if it's truly going to be encrypted. The problem that we have is that we are literally at an all-time low. And that is not a joke. It is literally the all-time low for trust in Facebook. Nobody trusts Facebook, and rightfully so. I think they violated privacy over and over and over. And so for him to come out and say, hey, I want to go ahead and do this, I mean, okay, great, but it's really hard to believe that even if they are putting this up, and let's say I've got, 100 friends on Facebook or whatever this is, but I'm only sharing with those people I want to share, it'd be very hard for me to think that on the back end, they're not getting access to this in some way, shape, or form. I mean, if they're running the encryption system, there's no reason why they can't decrypt it, read it, and re-encrypt it, on its way to, the friend that I have invited into my digital living room. So I find that interesting. I'd be curious to know what you guys think. Can we actually trust this? There are other more secure platforms out there that allow you to communicate with groups of people that don't data mine you. For example, Slack. I use Slack, in my family. So my wife's got it. One of the kids that's old enough has it, and we can all communicate within that ecosystem, and it's not data mined. It's geared for business, but you can use the free edition of it, and it's private, it's secure, it keeps the history of your messages, and it doesn't, it's not going to data mine you. And so how is Zuckerberg going to compete with that? And I'm curious to know, just because Slack has trust worldwide of major corporations, Facebook does not. Now, an interesting aside to this is that the founder of the World Wide Web, Tim Berners-Lee, has basically been doing exactly what Zuckerberg is now claiming he wants to do. Tim Berners-Lee created a company called Inrupt that literally gives you what's called a pod, and this pod is encrypted. It's basically a container where you can store notes and whatever you want, and then you can share your pod or aspects of your pod with those people you choose, and it is basically decentralized, and it is yours to do with what you want. And I think that is a very interesting, and novel approach to this, because Tim Berners-Lee basically hates what the World Wide Web has become in terms of lack of privacy and civility and all of this, kind of wants to burn it down, kind of wants to do it over. And Inrupt, is one of those companies that is attempting to do just that. Now, that said, he does not have the media presence, unfortunately, of a Mark Zuckerberg. And if I can get that guy on here for an interview, I would absolutely love to do that, because I'd love to pick his brain on this. But that is your news of the day. Can we trust Zuckerberg as he is moving to private and encrypted communication systems? You tell me. And in weakening the United States news, and this is the only way I can really, say this or categorize it, is if you're not familiar, we have a governing body called NIST, N-I-S-T. This is the National Institute for Standards and Technology. And basically, they are involved very heavily in setting, let's say, scientific standards, across the globe. They really are. They also set our watches to this. They broadcast the radio stations that broadcast the exact synchronized time. And so we have exact synchronized time. But one of the things they do that has been incredibly important since about 1990 or so is they actually run a cybersecurity framework that has essentially been the gold standard worldwide. I mean, it's been adopted, ripped off, changed, renamed, et cetera, over and over and over by various organizations and other compliance standards. But the NIST 800-171 cybersecurity framework is essentially the framework that is a living document that continues to be improved on as we advance in technology. And it is beyond essential. So many corporations, organizations, and the U.S. government adhere to this standard to ensure that they have some of the best data security planning and cybersecurity planning out there. And do not confuse data and cybersecurity. They're two different animals. Data security is under the umbrella of cybersecurity. I digress, though, and I can go on to that for an hour. But the reason why I'm bringing this up is that This administration, the Trump administration, has decided to cut funding for NIST by one third. Now, this also includes basically lowering the budget for the department, which is NSIT in NIST. They're the ones that actually deal with a cybersecurity framework. And I think that this is absolutely horrible. And we have seen a proliferation of attacks, of new innovations, of state-sponsored hacking, you know, of all these different kinds of new forms of malware, wireless malware and everything. And if we are not investing the resources and the personnel for those that are going to study and then expand this framework holistically to start covering new threats and new methodologies and new forms of communication, we are doing ourselves a serious, serious disservice. If NIST goes defunct for this reason, or they can't keep up with this growing threat, we start ending up with gaps in our cyber defense for things like the US military, for things like the corporations that we adhere to, for things like HIPAA compliance, because HIPAA is based off of NIST. It is a cybersecurity framework, but it adopts a lot of its standards basically when NIST comes out with new innovations and ways to defend yourself. This is the core of cyber defense strategy. And if we stop funding it, if this gets taken away, we are putting ourselves at a serious, serious disadvantage. And I've literally been here talking on other news items and all of that regarding government hacking or the Chinese breaking in us or the Russians or the Iranians or, you know, take your pick. And it's NIST that helps us. When we are able to fully adhere to this, we are solid and we are significantly more safe than if we are not. And so it is very disheartening for me and is very troubling for me as well. And you know me, I do not tend to get political. You know, I have my own opinions. I try to keep them, you know, off the air in this sense. But this is one of those things where I fundamentally disagree, you know, with this administration and what they're doing. If they have this entire push for security, building a wall on the southern border is one thing that let's say amps up security, but we have a massive problem with cybersecurity because you don't need to enter this country physically to get into our corporations, to get into our government, to get into all of these different things, and then exfiltrate the data. And I could postulate that that is significantly more harmful, stealing billions in intellectual property annually from the government than anybody crossing the border would be. Now, obviously, you know, terrorism aside, It's a serious, serious problem. We have to look at this holistically. And stay tuned to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show as we take a quick break for a public service announcement. We'll be back right after that.